This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, this is now season four of our podcast, so we've been watching some different TV shows related to OBGYN, and they're quite entertaining and interesting. So we were just maybe going to trade some notes on those, and we'll try not to talk too much about abortion because we've covered that so much before, but maybe a little bit. And then also there's a few articles from JAMA and a couple other journals as well that were interesting for us to just spend a little bit of time on. But first, what's the thing we do for no reason?
Well, how about checking uric acid levels when we evaluate patients for preeclampsia?
All right, this is a good one. So this is when a patient comes in with hypertension and we check some labs as part of this initial evaluation that usually would include a complete blood count, a metabolic panel with liver enzymes, and sometimes folks will also get an LDH and a uric acid as well.
Yeah, exactly. And we can throw the LDH in there for that matter, along with the uric acid, is something that we don't do for any good reason.
Yeah, I agree. So I think I know where you're going with this, but I'll let you elaborate.
Well, we do know that uric acid is elevated in patients who have severe preeclampsia, or the more severe the preeclampsia is, let's say, the higher the elevations of uric acid. It may even be the case that how elevated it is correlates in some meaningful way with how severe the disease is, but we don't do anything differently in how we manage the patient based upon whatever that level of uric acid is, and we don't use it as a diagnostic criteria. It's not part of the diagnostic criteria. So when we check one, it's at best just academic curiosity because it doesn't have any practical meaning when it comes to treating the patient.
And the elevation of uric acid is probably just a sign of the degree of renal dysfunction that's associated with their hypertension. But we already have diagnostic criteria to assess that incorporates renal function within the diagnosis of preeclampsia, and that would be the serum creatinine, and also the amount of protein in the urine. So the only labs that really play a direct role in diagnosing preeclampsia or diagnosing severe versus not severe features of preeclampsia would be the platelet level, the liver enzymes, the creatinine, and then whether there's proteinuria or maybe a spot urine protein to creatinine ratio. But the LDH is often thrown in there as an automatic thing along with the uric acid. So why do you think that is?
I think it's sort of the same story. LDH does tend to elevate with more severe disease, but we're really talking about the most severe disease, which will be apparent to the clinician from other factors. The other things you just listed will be elevated long before you'll see a significant elevation of LDH. And if you're wondering whether the patient in front of you may have acute anemia secondary to hemolysis, then seeing a markedly elevated LDH will help to confirm that it is in fact due to hemolysis. And hemolysis, of course, is a very concerning feature of severe preeclampsia or HELLP syndrome and other rarer conditions. But we should order those labs in a stepwise manner. So if you discover a significant anemia and you're wanting to know whether this is related to acute hemolysis, then yeah, go ahead and check an LDH. But 99 times out of 100, these labs are essentially going to be normal, meaning there's no significant anemia present to begin with or reason to suspect hemolysis as part of HELLP syndrome or something. So the test just becomes a waste of money.
Yeah, we should order tests if we have a specific plan for how those results are going to change the management of the patient. But neither we, the care team, the physicians, or the patients are usually directly penalized with the costs of those extra unnecessary tests. But maybe another motivator besides costs to not order tests that we don't actually care about might be if we actually did have to address every abnormality. So I remember at one point, I started to get emails from the coders at my hospital whenever, like this happened a lot, whenever I'd order a chem panel for a hypertensive patient, and then maybe their sodium or their potassium would be 1 point outside of normal, but not clinically significant at all. And of course, I never needed the sodium or potassium to begin with for most of those patients. But then the coders would ask me to document, is this underlying hyponatremia, acute hyponatremia, or other, please explain. And I got those emails so much eventually at that hospital, I made a new order set so that I would only check those labs that we listed that were actually relevant to preeclampsia evaluation. And then I stopped getting the emails. But in general, I think it's so common for those initial default labs to include a lot of those extra things, like a chem panel includes sodium, potassium, chloride, bicarb, and then maybe alkphos, which is always abnormal in pregnancy, and then uric acid and LDH and all of those other things. And where I'm at now, even the blood count by default includes this expanded differential. It has things like a reticulocyte count. That is always abnormal. So it gets to the point where seeing a red flag next to a lab result, it just doesn't even register. Like, it's in a way, it's kind of like an alarm fatigue, and not to mention the extra cost of doing all those extra labs.
Yeah. And in the book, A Clinical Reasoning, the new book, I talk about this a little bit in the sense of the way we determine normal lab values is basically we take a population of healthy volunteers and we check the lab of interest, and then we determine the range of those labs, the median plus or minus 2 standard deviations, and that's what that normal lab value is out on the right-hand side of your labs. So everything in the tail of the distribution turns red. So roughly 2.5% at the top and 2.5% at the bottom of healthy people will have those abnormal labs, and they'll therefore be red when you check them. This is the same way that p-values work with studies, where we're just kind of looking at the distribution, the frequency of expected data sets, and we're marking all the ones that are at the tails of the distribution as areas of interest. It doesn't mean that they're abnormal, just as much as a p-value doesn't mean that a finding in a study is significant clinically, or even true. It just means that's the area where we should look and think about it. Now, the point of that is those lab values are based upon healthy volunteers. So every time you run one, a single test, you have a 5% chance of finding in a healthy person an abnormality. Now, if you do the math, if you run 30 tests on a person, then you've got a more likely than not chance that at least one thing is going to be abnormal. So it's sort of the multiple hypothesis problem. And so it's actually unusual that you run a test, a CBC and a CMP or a couple of other labs, and don't see at least one red value. And then, of course, in pregnancy, those normal values are set for, I'm guessing, 200-pound white men. And so things like the creatinine and the hemoglobin are going to be red often in pregnant women anyway, because we didn't base these numbers on pregnant women. So again, you need sufficient pretest probability to order the test you're ordering and then know what to do with that. But if you just order a shotgun panel of tests on people, you're going to come up with lots of abnormalities that, as you're saying, you're kind of forced to stick with. And then, yeah, the money. And none of these are, each individual lab may not be that expensive, but those costs add up. The tests we're talking about, the LDH and the uric acid, they're maybe $20 a piece, depending on different variables. So maybe $40 added to the lab evaluation of every patient you see with hypertension. But do that, say, a couple hundred times a year, and you've spent $8,000. And larger hospitals like yours may triage that many patients with hypertension and who are pregnant every month. And again, maybe even $8,000 doesn't seem like a lot, but if you add up all these little things, unnecessary type in screens, unnecessary postpartum or postoperative hemoglobins or other labs, CBCs, things like that, if you add all that up, it comes to quite a bit. If a hospital does 1,000 deliveries a year and you spend $200 on unnecessary labs on every patient, which is really quite easy to do, that's $200,000 a year that's not spent for healthcare. It's a low value or zero value expense. And in a civilian world, that doesn't get reimbursed by the payers. So the hospital and its patients basically suffer from that. That's $200,000 that could have been paying for that new ultrasound machine you needed, or maybe paying the salaries of 3 RNs for your unit or something like that. So these are real costs and have real implications.
Okay, well, let's move on, because we can get really passionate about these things we do for no reason. But in the last episode, we talked about maternal mortality, and we mentioned that we might see another sharp increase in maternal death statistics because of the COVID pandemic. There has been a report published in the JAMA Network Open that says maternal deaths did increase by 33% from right before the pandemic to during the pandemic, because we're still in it, really. And in that data, they saw nearly a 2,400% increase in deaths that were categorized as being from viral diseases, and also 117% increase in deaths from diseases of the respiratory system. So I think you can put two and two together here. That's COVID. And COVID definitely had a large impact on maternal mortality, as that report shows. We don't have the final total numbers yet for how many women died in 2021, but this does give us a clue of how much the increase might be during those 2 years when we get the data finally analyzed.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we all knew this was going to happen. We've been talking about COVID since we started the podcast, and it's a reminder, though, of how maternal deaths, to me, spiked after the Spanish flu epidemic 100 years ago. In 1919 and 1920, maternal mortality rose to levels that hadn't been seen since the 1880s or 1890s, and that was during a time where there had been a dramatic decline in maternal mortality in the previous 30 or 40 years, and then the flu came along. And that's what we're going to see, unfortunately, again from COVID. I think if you ask the average OBGYN what the most important things we do for pregnant women are in terms of saving lives and overall decreasing maternal and perinatal mortality and morbidity, I think a lot of them would not upfront include the flu shot prior maybe to the events of the last few years. But the flu shot is maybe one of the most significant things we do for women. And now we see that the COVID vaccination, especially over the last 2 years, has saved countless numbers of lives of pregnant women and could have saved even more had we been more effective in getting women to take the shot.
Yeah, there is kind of a more recent example of this too. Back in 2009 to 2010, there was the H1N1 flu virus pandemic. That was the swine flu. And at that time, the H1N1 wasn't part of the standard flu shot. And so a separate flu shot was released that year just for that strain. And it was estimated that less than half of the population actually got that shot. And now that the numbers have been analyzed, there's some pretty good detailed studies on this. Pregnant women were among the most sensitive group for getting severe illness from H1N1. And they figured that with a vaccine that was only, I think, 60% effective, there was still a pretty low number needed to treat for, it was like give 34 shots to prevent one case of severe disease or death in pregnant women. So with less than half of pregnant women getting that shot, There was a spike in maternal mortality that year of about 12%. So I suppose it could have been much better if more of them had gotten that H1N1 shot. But also 12% is much better than the 33% so far that we've seen from COVID. So yeah, we often forget how effective things like the flu shot are. And of course, now the standard flu shot does include H1N1. And of course, it's not just women dying. It's also women having near-death, severe illnesses and critical care experiences. We'd like to avoid those too, because those are associated with long-term effects for the baby. The preterm deliveries and things like that, that go along with severe flu or severe COVID cases.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it does seem like we live in a time where our sort of cultural conscience is forgotten how dangerous many of vaccine preventable diseases were. And maybe we should talk about that sometime just with childhood vaccines too, of how big of an impact and how many lives are saved by the fact that we have routine and fairly standard vaccination. But we don't see it anymore. We don't see polio, and we rarely see pertussis and these sorts of things. So no one really realizes how valuable these shots are. At a time where we live closer together and have more travel with each other and all those sorts of things that should make these sorts of diseases more common than ever, if we lived in a world today without routine vaccinations, the burden of deaths would be fairly astonishing, I think, to most people. But okay, well, let me ask you this. Have you had your coffee today?
Yes. Why do you ask?
Well, you'll be excited to know about a new study from the International Journal of Epidemiology published in June that looked at the effects of maternal coffee consumption on birth weight, stillbirth rates, miscarriage rates, gestational age at delivery, and the preterm birth rate.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll go make another cup. But before I do, tell me what they found.
Well, essentially, they were trying to determine whether some of the observational data that we've seen published in the past that's linked higher amounts of coffee or really caffeine consumption to some of those negative outcomes, whether this was causal or just associations. Is the caffeine causing these problems or is it just associated with it? So in this study, they looked at several single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, that we know are associated with coffee consumption. And they also looked at the relationship between alcohol and smoking with some of those SNPs. You might realize that people who drink a lot of coffee also are people who tend to smoke more and maybe drink more alcohol. And so there's actually some genetic reasons for that predilection. So anyway, they did a statistical analysis to see whether or not the observed adverse outcomes in pregnancy were associated with the presence of these genetic polymorphisms or with the habit of drinking lots of coffee or caffeine.
Well, I do drink coffee, but just to clarify, I don't smoke.
No one accused you of smoking, but maybe you have those SNPs. I don't know. In any event, they concluded that it's probably not the coffee consumption or the caffeine consumption that contributes to these adverse outcomes like stillbirth or miscarriage or preterm birth, but that there's potentially just an underlying genetic confounder that's gone unnoticed.
Honestly, I was hoping you were going to say that coffee is protective against those bad outcomes, but I guess what you're actually saying is that I may or may not have a gene that predisposes me to drinking coffee and or smoking and or drinking alcohol. And that same gene could also predispose me to miscarriages, but it's not the coffee's fault. So I don't know if that's good news necessarily, but I guess it means I can still keep drinking coffee.
You can have your coffee when you're pregnant again.
Okay.
But I will say this is the problem we always make, right? This sort of association and causation issues. It's a very common human mistake where association equals causation in our brains. But as we learn more about biology and learn more about genes and how all this stuff probably really works, genes have a much bigger influence. And don't even start about epigenetic factors, right? But they have a much bigger influence than we give them credit for. It may not be immediately obvious to somebody that a certain set of genes that might be associated with a certain poor health outcome might also be associated with a proclivity to do certain things, like eat certain foods, drink certain things, certain activities, things like that. So I'm often reminded that we are very much still just observing superficial things in science without understanding the real causes in this very complex system of biology. And that's why our intuition always seems to fail us. I'll say also that if you look at individual studies that have implicated caffeine over the years as injurious in some way during pregnancy, particularly in the first trimester, none of them really are great studies. They all on their own merit kind of fall down. They're usually retrospective studies that are based upon kind of poor quality data. They don't really adjust for many confounders. And when they do adjust for confounders, it's things like height and weight and whether you smoke or not. But you never see retrospective studies that adjust for confounders like sets of single nucleotide polymorphisms in your DNA. And that's what they've tried to do here.
And it's, I guess another reason they looked into this is because obviously a lot of people still seem to think that caffeine is bad in pregnancy. I meet these people every day. It's just like this default assumption. But in the medical community, I think we've always known that it's not really true. It's never really been proven. And then now more recently, people like this research group and then others have actually been trying to get to the bottom of it.
You know, I've tried to figure this out myself and figure out why there's this sort of myth around caffeine. And I honestly believe that it has a simple answer. When I was a kid, and maybe when you were a kid, my parents told me, don't drink coffee, don't drink caffeine because it would stunt my growth. That was always the little reason I shouldn't drink caffeine. And what kid wants their growth stunted? But I think they really didn't want me drinking caffeine so that I'd go to bed on time and not be a wild child who was out of control. But I think that became sort of a popular urban myth, a little white lie we tell kids, if you will. And if a little kid shouldn't drink caffeine because it could cause growth abnormalities, right, then certainly a pregnant woman shouldn't drink caffeine because it might stunt the growth or cause an adverse effect of the fetus. So I think it's really just that simple. And then we just all assumed that it was bad because our parents told us it was.
That makes sense. Just should have asked the parents to explain and prove their theory. Well, there are a lot of organizations. I think even ACOG publishes some sort of cutoff for milligrams of safe caffeine consumption per day, and it's usually 200 to 300 milligram range during pregnancy. But those same organizations also admit that there's no strong data that these cutoffs are scientific. So perhaps this study will influence that a little bit. I do think in pregnancy, people will still often tend to take the better safe than sorry approach, and maybe it, in some cases to an unhealthy extreme. So in the absence of knowing about absolute safety of a medicine or of a food or drink, they'll just say, well, let's just totally skip it then.
Yeah, definitely. But the sort of randomness in that approach is my problem with it. What I mean is, why pick caffeine or coffee or something? Why not lemonade? Perhaps lemonade excess consumption in pregnancy is this horrible thing and we've just not studied it. So there's still that inherent bias that assumes that coffee is bad and lemonade is good. And that bias is represented in these recommendations and frankly, in a lot of other recommendations.
Yeah, there's all these other things we haven't studied either, right? Like sweet tea or bubble tea or hot chocolate. They could all be really bad too.
Or bubble baths or chocolate baths. I don't know. But you might upset a lot of women if you suggest they need to quit their sweet tea, particularly in the South.
Okay, well, those are just hypotheticals. If people keep drinking your sweet tea if you want until it gets studied. Maybe one day we'll know for sure.
I bet it's associated with an increased risk of gestational diabetes.
Probably that. Okay, well, let's move on. There was an interesting paper in the European Journal of Public Health last month called Changing Effectiveness of Mammography Screening with Decreasing Breast Cancer Mortality. And I'll just read the conclusion here. This touches on some of the things we talked about in a prior episode about mammography. So they say, due to increasingly potent therapeutic modalities, the benefit of mammography in terms of reduced breast cancer mortality declines, while the harms, including overdiagnosis, are unaffected, and future improvements in breast cancer patient management will further deteriorate the benefit-harm ratio of screening. And that's the end of that quote. So we decide how to use those tests and whom we use those tests for based on that benefit-to-harm ratio. And the point of this study was to show that over the last 30 years or so, the benefit of mammography continues to decline significantly, while the harms essentially remain the same. So this, I think, further argues for using the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force screening guidelines for mammography rather than what we still commonly follow, which is annual screening starting at age 40.
Yeah, the article was good, I thought. And it's one of many things to consider when making guidelines, all of these sort of metrics that go into the formula of who we should do tests on and how often, they're all kind of moving targets, especially when you think about their point that treatments have gotten better, the disease is less mortal and less morbid than it was due to better treatments, things like that. So, and also the tests maybe are better. I mean, there's still some debate about 3D versus standard. So all these things are moving targets. So what was true 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago about a philosophy of guideline for screening might not be true today as those things change.
On that note, that reminds me of something we were recently talking about again regarding abortions.
Abortions, huh? I don't think the listeners are probably too bored yet to hear about it. Obviously, I know in my circle of OBGYN friends, this is something they're not tired of talking about. So, but tell me.
Okay. Well, some days I think I reach my limit pretty quickly on this topic, at least while I'm scrolling through social media and seeing articles about abortion or little 140-character social media posts about it. And we've talked about it at length previously before. So I just want to focus on a couple very specific questions today. So the first one is emergency contraception on the chopping block now that abortions have been banned in many states. And there's a lot of articles and some pretty, I think, pretty good news websites that talk about this. So right now, no. Emergency contraception isn't banned anywhere, and it's not included in any of the state laws that have banned abortion. None of them touch this. But at the same time, it's not a specifically protected right either to access emergency contraception. And the fear is that because there's so many non-medical people that think emergency contraception kills a fertilized egg, they equate that to abortion. Those are the after conception occurs. Some of these laws will basically ban abortion after conception. And so they would equate emergency contraception with that if that's how it worked. That's not how it works, though, but it's a very reasonable fear that future law proposals that would target emergency contraception could be allowed to pass as part of an abortion ban.
Yeah, and again, it gets into the mechanism of action. I agree that most people don't really know. I would say even in the OBGYN community, honestly, that there's a lot of not good understanding about the actual mechanisms of action. There's a lot of talk about theoretic mechanisms of action, but what actually happens with a lot of birth control, I don't think is well understood. So we should definitely talk about the mechanisms of action sometime. There's actually, for example, really good data that indicates that IUDs, for example, are almost exclusively preconceptual, maybe even more so than birth control pills. But you see people who argue that IUDs are abortifacient. So even from a pro-life perspective, there's no reason to believe that any of the current birth control products are abortifacient. Now, as far as emergency contraception, Plan B is certainly not something. It will only work if you're not pregnant, if there is no conception. A Paragard IUD 10 days after conception, maybe that will be the subject of controversy. But the over-the-counter Plan B and the things that people normally think of as emergency contraception are by no means abortifacient, even from the most aggressive definitions. But none of the laws, as you said, have targeted birth control products in any way. And so some of that is also a little bit of fear of what might come. Okay, what was the second thing?
Okay, this was related to something that you brought up recently, that thought was a pretty good point. So, of course, one of our concerns with these abortion bans is the potential for a rise in illicit and unsafe abortions. And we know that worldwide, unsafe abortions account for a lot of maternal mortality. And of course, that's mainly in developing countries. But in attempts to predict what could happen in the US, we've seen estimates of up to 5,000 women a year dying of abortions before Roe was passed back in the 70s. And so the implication is that now that Roe has been repealed, we'll go back to having a number like that in the very near future. And that is a horrendous thought, considering that the current maternal mortality crisis in the U.S. encompasses only about 900 women a year. So you could imagine that if suddenly that number jumped up 5 or 6 times because of illegal abortions, that would be worse than a crisis. That would be a state of emergency or very dystopian. But you wanted to fact check this figure, right? So you want to tell us what you found?
Yeah, I see it a lot on social media, but the number of 4,000 or 5,000 women a year dying of illegal abortions in the late 60s, early 70s, it never made sense to me on the surface. I spent a lot of time studying maternal mortality through the decades in the last couple of centuries in the United States and in other countries. In fact, it's a theme of the new book I'm writing, essentially. So that number never really passed the sniff test for me, that there were 5,000 in 71 or 70. But in looking for this, I found a 2019 article from the Washington Post that was actually started out as a fact check of a Planned Parenthood claim that 5,000 women a year died prior to the passage of Roe. And it turned out to be a really well done research article that looks at a lot of the aspects of that claim. They investigated the source of the number in an ACOG statement and another written things from Planned Parenthood and other organizations. And they tried to track down the source of the original claim and then did some analysis to understand what the real number might have been. It's well worth reading. And of course, I'll put a link there. I couldn't do it justice to recreate their work here on the podcast, but it's well worth reading if you're interested in this topic.
So what did they conclude was the real number of yearly deaths from abortions?
Well, the truth is, there's probably no way we can know the actual real number because many of the abortions were illegal. And because of that, undoubtedly, they were underreported or covered up or attributed maybe to something else due to the illegality surrounding the death. So that's the thing that makes it at its surface sort of difficult to do. But in the last year before Roe was passed, the CDC reported that in the United States, there were 24 deaths from legally obtained abortions and 39 from illegally obtained abortions in the United States. So that number, I'm sure, is higher than 39, but there's no reason to think that it is dramatically higher than 39. And also note that women died in the legally obtained abortions category, too. The delta there is 15 in a time when maybe most abortions were legal prior to Roe. So I don't know the exact number because we don't know the exact number of illegal abortions. There's a lot of things we don't know there. But clearly, a delta of 15 over the deaths from legal abortions is a dramatically different story than 5,000.
I know that there could have been many that were swept under the rug somehow, hush-hush, or not documented correctly because of stigma. But 39 is very different from 5,000. So how do you think they ever got to the number 5,000?
Well, the article goes through the story of that, but I guess a really simple explanation is that people made estimates and they always sort of took the most extreme estimates. So how many illegal abortions could there be in a year? Let's take the top number. And how many women, what percentage of those women might die? Let's take the top number of the estimate. And they came up with a number that was perhaps the worst case scenario, but certainly not the probable scenario. We do this all the time. In other words, somewhere between 50 and 5,000 women die of abortions. Let's go with 5,000, is sort of what they did. But the real problem is that those estimates also were done in the late 30s, and they come from a time before we had antibiotics available. And it's really antibiotics that changed the game in maternal mortality in general, but also very specifically from abortions, whether illegal or legally obtained abortions. Antibiotics were the things that dramatically cut down on maternal mortality. So by 1972, death from abortion in any format was dramatically lower than it had been 30 years prior when those estimates were created. But the estimates just kept being repeated. The article, like I said, is definitely worth reading, and it shows how politics can affect science. Now, both sides of the current debate are guilty of this sort of exaggeration and hyperbole and things like that. So I'm definitely not singling out anyone or either side of the debate. But I do think it's important that we should talk about real numbers, because when you make some rhetorical point based upon data that the Washington Post has fact-checked and rebutted 3 years ago, you're going to lose the argument in the public perception when it turns out that this was just a massive exaggeration. So I don't think it's helpful to either side to lie or exaggerate about what we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. We kind of hurt our credibility if, while we're advocating for safe abortions, we use some easily disputable statistic when we're trying to make our case. But whatever the real number was or whatever it might be, I don't think anybody wants women to feel pushed into getting back alley abortions, regardless of the number. But I guess we just don't have a really good prediction for how many women could pursue these or how many could die of them. I guess all I can say is now that we have antibiotics, if those illegal abortions are going to happen in this country, then I hope they
come to the hospital.
Yeah.
When you get sick, come to the hospital and we'll take care of you.
Antibiotics.
Yeah. And the abortions, that article points out that maybe 90% of illegal abortions at the time were actually being done by physicians. So I think if you think about, like, I was trying to think about a model, how would you model what might happen? And there's a few things. One is abortion is still legal in obviously roughly half the country, but obviously it's illegal. I mean, it's still legal in states where abortion is more common. So the vast majority of abortions will still be available to women who want them because it's legal in those states. And then women in states where it's curtailed, almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them border a state where it's legal. So I'm sure a lot of women will travel out of state to get abortions. And then illegal abortions, I think the face of illegal abortions in 2023 is going to be mail order mifepristone and misoprostol from India. So that's quite a bit different than back alley abortions.
Yeah, because those are still safe, evidence-based regimens.
Yeah. And then finally, the people who do have coat hanger type abortions like you think of, I do think that there's hopefully less stigma about them coming to the hospital if they get in trouble. And obviously, we're ready to help them if they show up. So,
well,
we'll see.
Yeah, we'll hope for the best and do what we can. Let's move on. You were telling me about a new show you were watching on AMC.
Yeah, AMC Plus. I feel like we're obligated to talk about depictions of obstetrics in television shows after we did a couple of episodes on that before, and people like those episodes. But there's this show on AMC Plus called Dark Winds. It's set on a Navajo reservation in 1971 or 1972, I think. And in the first episode, there's a scene where a white doctor is talking to a pregnant Navajo lady, and his nurse is there acting as a translator. He's encouraging her to deliver in the hospital instead of having a home birth by means of his nurse translator. The translator tells her in their native language that the doctor wants to sterilize her against her will and do surgery on her without her consent. And even though she's putting words in the doctor's mouth, the doctors actually were sterilizing Native American women without their consent. So the translator is actually acting to protect the patient from the doctor. Now, it's the first episode of this series where that occurs, so even if you don't subscribe to AMC Plus, I think you can watch it for free. But the extent of sterilization of Native American women in the 1960s and 1970s was something that the U.S. government later admitted to, and I'll put a link to an article that documents this history. As many as 1 in 4 Native American women were of reproductive age at the time were sterilized without their knowledge and against their will by the U.S. government. In the late 60s and early 70s.
That's pretty horrible. Some would classify that as, in a way, genocide. But one of the things that came out of the government's admission to this practice, which was in the mid-70s, was the development of a Medicaid consent to sterilization form that a lot of GYNs today find frustrating because anyone who gets their sterilization paid for with federal dollars has to sign a form and be given a 30-day window to take the form home and have it read by family and friends. And if applicable, to say they've been provided with a translator, and then the translator would have to sign it to ensure that they understand what they're consenting to. And that's the opposite of what used to happen. But now a lot of folks view this as even a roadblock to getting sterilized, and at a minimum, a frustrating nuisance. But it's just a relic of kind of a shameful practice in our history. And I think a lot of people might be shocked to realize that this was happening in the U.S. less than 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's astounding. We can't always trust the government, and we tend to ignore things that our own government has done, from Japanese internment to things like that. I do think it's shocking to people, and people do complain about those forms today. And so every time I see one, it's just a reminder of this was literally happening in the United States. And I'm from the government. I'm here to help you, and forcing sterilizations on women without their consent. But there's a pregnant woman in the show who does feature in significantly in the program. And later, in another episode, it's implied that she had a test to determine the baby's gender in 1971 while she was early pregnant. So that was the other OB connection in that series. And I'm afraid that's obviously a bit of an anachronism that the writers might have screwed up on a little bit. But otherwise, it's a good series. So, and you were telling me about a book you read recently about an OBGYN.
Yeah. And maybe I'll get to that show that you just told us about. It sounds pretty good. But there's another show on AMC Plus called This Is Going to Hurt, and it's based on a book. And because I don't subscribe to AMC Plus and I couldn't watch the whole series of the show, I bought the book. And it was written by an OBGYN called, his name's Adam Kay, and he lives in Britain. And his character is played by Ben Whishaw, and who played Q in the James Bond movies, and I liked his character a lot. So anyway, that's why I read the book. The book is based on Adam Kay's diaries while he was an OBGYN resident in the UK. This was about 15 years ago, and they have slightly different terms for the resident, intern, resident, senior resident, and stuff. But essentially, the book was from the time he began his medical training all the way to becoming a senior trainee, like a chief resident. And I think it was really entertaining. I can see why they made a show about it. And it was also really eye-opening and a little bit dark as well. Kind of melancholy, at least in the end, and sometimes a little bit unsettling, but it's very easily readable. He wrote it during his training, and so a lot of the entries are really short, so it's easy to kind of pick up and read a bit and then stop. And now he's a comedy writer now, so it's even then it was, he put a lot of what funny things did his patients say or do, and some of them are really hilarious. The spoiler is that he got out of medicine, and you can kind of get why as you read it. It's full of some really, I think, appalling descriptions of his training conditions, and it's not really what I expected OBGYN training to look like in a country that reports having much lower maternal and perinatal mortality rates than the U.S. does.
Well, we know how that goes.
Yeah, listen to our last episode. But still, I guess I thought that they were at least as advanced as the U.S., if not more, in their medical training. And maybe it is different there now, but at least back when he was going through it, he painted this picture of really severe, excessive workload, like an inhumane workload, along with a striking lack of supervision, lack of support, and just horrible morale. He and all of his colleagues were always expected to stay many hours beyond their assigned shifts every day to finish up. And not uncommonly, he'd have to end up covering for someone else straight after his shift was over, just do a whole nother shift because someone else called out and we need you. Then he would do clinics and they would be overbooked. They would run well into 6 or 7 p.m. Patients would be seen hours late and they'd always be furious. And then when he'd be in the hospital, he'd get paged seemingly like every 5 minutes. He'd run to an emergency, he'd be in the middle of dealing with that, and then two more would simultaneously call out for him, and he wouldn't have any backup. He'd have to actually juggle all of that without his staff coming in and really without any of them expressing gratitude. Sometimes his patients would be thankful, but he wouldn't get that from his workplace. And then his attendings, which they called him consultants, seemed to be in general callous and intimidating, and the whole stereotypical, like, don't call me, just deal with all the emergencies yourself overnight. And then as far as the safety for patients, that obviously that would have suffered in a system like this. He had one story about a patient who the ER said has an intrauterine pregnancy, so she almost got sent home, but actually she had a ruptured ectopic, not an intrauterine pregnancy. So thankfully, they were able to operate on her before she died. But had she gone home based on what the ER said, then she probably would have died at home. And that kind of thing seemed to happen a lot. Some of his training locations didn't have any parking set aside for doctors. They would forbid them from parking. And even though the public transportation system would take them twice as long to get to and from work. So he was basically describing, throughout all of his little hilarious anecdotes, also a lot of burnout, a lot of moral injury. Of course, it affected his personal life too. He talks about that. And then he does give this spoiler away at the very intro of the book. So this all came to a head for him. He had a case where a patient had placenta previa, but it had been missed during all of her antenatal care. So he met her for the first time during the day of her delivery. He didn't know she had previa because it wasn't on her diagnosis list. And she ended up almost bleeding to death. She had to get a hysterectomy and be in the ICU for a while. And her baby did die during the process just because of all the blood loss. So at that point, he was almost done with his training, but somehow this outcome just weighed so heavily on him. He said this woman was so lovely and just felt like he was in charge and he failed her. And he quit medicine. He got out and became a comedy writer before he even was totally done with his training. So anyway, that was just his experience. I know that before there were work hour restrictions in the U.S., probably a lot of American doctors had it at least much worse than I did. Maybe as bad as Adam K. did, but training experience, I think, was way better than his was. And I think a lot safer than what he described. And I can only hope that in the UK, it has improved since when he was training and since he got out. And at the end of the book, he has some words about how he thinks the conditions of medical residents and practicing doctors in the UK needs to get better. I think he's kind of become an advocate for that. And as far as the quitting medicine thing goes, maybe it's nice to have an example of that actually working out for somebody. Because if a doctor is considering quitting medicine, they've got to be in a lot of distress to be even thinking about that, whatever the reason is. So it would only add to the distress to feel like, well, I have no other options. I don't have any other skills, just the doctor thing. So I'm stuck. So I guess it's nice to know that that's not true. But on the flip side, I think if every doctor had a bad outcome or a bad work environment and they just quit medicine, then we'd be in a crisis for sure, because then there would be zero doctors. And then there would be this whole flood of unemployed former doctors trying to compete for some random jobs like physician consulting or something. So hopefully people take away some good points from this book, because I think it is pretty funny and also a little bit thought-provoking. But yeah, hopefully it doesn't inspire people to just get up and quit medicine.
And I haven't read the book, but I have been watching the series, which hasn't concluded yet. So I think we should come back sometime after it's concluded and maybe you've watched it and talk about it. The series, we talked last year about how birth is portrayed in films and had an episode on that. And this is definitely the most realistic portrayal of a lot of birth-related things that has existed. They did a lot of work to make it accurate. They also fictionalized a lot. So I think the series is a bit different than the book. And so we could talk about that later. I don't want to talk about it now for spoilers, but they did invent a character who I think everyone will love named Shruti. And she's his junior doctor. And you'll really empathize with her, I think, in a way that she's not in the book, but they've done a good job with the series. So we'll come back and talk about that later and talk about some of the cases and things that they had in there. But it really does paint not a good picture for the NHS.
Yeah. All right. Well, for now, let's move on again. There was another new article this month in July 5th in JAMA, which was a randomized trial of intensive prenatal nurse home visiting on adverse birth outcomes in Medicaid patients. So they were trying to target low-income patients and improve their birth outcomes. They enrolled 5,670 Medicaid-eligible nulliparous pregnant women, and they were randomized either to usual care or to a program of intensive nurse visits at their home. And this was during their pregnancy through 2 years postpartum. And the nurses provided education, they performed assessments, they set goals related to prenatal health and child development and other various maternal life issues. And the control group got their regular prenatal care, and they would get referrals to community resources if they needed them. And I believe this was in South Carolina. So far, they published this paper for the outcomes that they have already finalized, but there's some that they haven't gotten all the data for yet. So as far as preterm birth, low birth weight, growth restriction, and perinatal death, they did not find any improvement in the group that had the home visits by the nurses. And they also looked at over 50 secondary outcomes, things like rate of cesarean delivery, severe maternal morbidity, very low birth weight, and a bunch of other things. And even in those, they didn't find any differences between the groups.
Well, I love it when negative studies are published. Too often, papers that don't find anything, they go unpublished, since there's a bias towards only publishing positive results in many of our journals. But this is meaningful and should affect how we think about allocating state dollars in programs like this, in states like South Carolina, other places where these sorts of programs have been started with the goal of improving or reducing some of the costly negative outcomes that we see, like preterm birth, where a baby that goes to the NICU costs the state a lot of money. My first thought when I saw this, though, was why did they think in the first place that having what are essentially amounts to educational visits to the home, why would that make a difference in any of the outcomes you just listed? Babies don't have growth restriction or die in utero or deliver prematurely due to a lack of education. So I'm not sure how any of the services provided would have even theoretically made a difference in those particular outcomes. And I think sometimes that gets at a lack of just understanding in our culture a little bit about what it is in prenatal care that's meaningful or effective, or maybe we overestimate the importance of certain aspects of prenatal care. It also shows that we don't have a lot of interventions to change outcomes, even if we do things to identify patients who are at risk. Meaning, let's say you think about educating them and then also checking blood pressures or screening for signs and symptoms of preterm labor or something like that. Okay, well, you do that and you find a patient who understands about risk factors and signs of preterm labor. But then once you identify her, you have no strategy that makes the preterm labor less likely or reduces the incidence of preterm labor once we've discovered it. So there's no good evidence that education can affect things like how big babies are, how small they are, or things like that. So we're tackling complex biomolecular problems with social solutions in a study like this, and it's quite a stretch to believe that they would be effective.
Well, yeah. And some of the other outcomes that they're still working up may still have some promise, because they're looking at birth interval, so rates of short interval pregnancy and some other child development, child injury, child abuse type outcomes. So maybe it's feasible that those could be more amenable to intensive education and nurse visits, maybe. But I wish that even from the beginning, they had also added some maybe more logical outcomes like patient satisfaction or mental health outcomes like the EPDS screen scores, for example, or maybe even rates of maternal smoking, maternal substance abuse. Maybe the nursing visits might have actually made a difference for those. And it may be that these visits were really productive and effective overall, but not for the reasons that they were looking for. So hopefully maybe we'll still see something good come out of this when they publish additional data. But yeah, there's not a really good reason to believe they were going to reduce the rate of preterm labor with these nurse visits. So I'll move on to another bit now. The CDC just released some data as of this month, July 2022, related to cesarean rates in the US. And I think it validates the claim that you've previously made on this podcast. So we've seen a stabilization, if not even a slight decline in cesarean rates in the US over the last 4 to 5 years. And you've said that you thought it was more due to a decline in the birth rate and decline in having repeat cesareans because of fewer pregnancies, and not due to actual progress in lowering the rate of primary cesarean delivery. So this new data definitely supports that.
Yeah, the CDC's published an analysis of changes in the primary and repeat cesarean delivery rates from 2016 to 2021, which has shown that the primary cesarean delivery rate has actually continued to increase, while the repeat cesarean delivery rate has declined slightly. And the result of that overall was a total cesarean rate that's fairly stable over the last few years. But if you think about what that means, it means that we're still doing more and more primary cesareans on first-time moms, or unscarred uteruses at least. But women are choosing to have fewer children, and therefore women with scarred uteruses are having fewer repeat cesareans. And so it looks like we're doing a good job, if you just look at the top of the page numbers, on decreasing the cesarean delivery rate in the U.S., or at least stemming the tide of what had been an increasing rate. But in fact, we're not improving our practice, at least not dramatically. And the cesarean rate, the primary cesarean rate, is continuing to go up. But as the birth rate has declined significantly in the last decade, there are fewer women having repeat cesareans. So,
yeah, the cherry on top in this data is that there were greater increases. I say that sarcastically. There were greater increases in cesareans for Black women and smaller declines in repeat cesareans among Black women, which, as we have pointed out in a prior episode, would tend to further widen the gap of maternal mortality between Black women and white women because Black women continue to be disproportionately cut. They're disproportionately the recipients of cesarean deliveries. And of course, that contributes much more to maternal mortality.
Yeah. And again, I think until we start seeing a lot of discussion about that, which you see basically zero now, we're not going to make much more improvements on the gap between Black and white maternal mortality in the United States.
Well, I think we should wrap up this first episode of our season 4. Links will be on Thinking About OBGYN website, thinkingaboutobgyn.com. And then we'll be back again in a couple more weeks.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.